Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Just a heads up, my friends, this first interview contains mature subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Gary Lacasse from the Canadian AIDS Society. So tell me a little bit about the AIDS Society.
The Canadian AIDS Society is a community-based effort. Our main mission is to be the voice of advocacy on a national level and to also develop programming for HIV and other comorbidities.
So, when it comes to being a voice of advocacy, what sort of initiatives do you have to that end?
Well, the initiatives that we have to that end is the blood ban that is currently in effect for men who have sex with men. And we've been advocating for decades to have it reduced to no waiting period for men who have sex with men, and changing the orientation questionnaire to a behavioral risk questionnaire. So that's an ongoing collaboration that we do with many sector people that are involved. We are also do a lot of research around cannabis, and we are one of the leading organizations in Canada that promoted the use of cannabis for medical reasons because of the high usage rates people living with HIV of cannabis for medical use. So we're in the process of terminating our research for creating guidelines for medical use of cannabis for chronic pain. Our protocol was just published by the British Medical Journal, so that was an amazing milestone here. And we also do a lot of solicitation on the Hill for different funding envelopes that are that can be used for sexually transmitted bloodborne infections. So that's generally it, and report to our membership.
So, in your work, do you find there are a lot of myths concerning HIV that are still out there?
Yes. One that's being perpetuated is the one that Trump just called out, that he said that we had a cure for HIV last week, which we don't. So a lot of people believe that HIV is not transmitted anymore, that it is a curable disease, which it's not. And in fact, in Canada, we're the only G7 countries experiencing extremely high increases in HIV transmissions. So just last year, we had a 25% increase of HIV cases from 2014, and it was the fifth consecutive year of increase.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by HIV?
There's almost 70,000 people living with HIV in Canada at the moment. That we have data that we think we are living. The issue that we have with our with the Public Health Agency Canada is that the data is not correct, as we saw with COVID. It highlighted that fact that the even though it's a it's a reportable disease. There's 60% of the data that we have is based on fact. The rest is only estimate. So there's some good data, but we have to improve our data analysis systems in Canada on every level, not just with HIV, with everything, because of our federation in health care. Or as I always say, our biggest roadblock to positive health outcomes for Canadians is our own healthcare system. Because what happens in Newfoundland isn't the same rules and regulations that happen in Ontario.
So, what are some of the challenges for the society?
Sustainability is one of them. In a critical change in funding landscape in 2016, the Public Health Agency of Canada cut funding to about, through a solicitation process, to about 40 organizations across Canada that were dealing with HIV, which we think was the impetus in what happened with the increase in HIV cases, because the care and support or secondary prevention cascade was not covered anymore in those 40 organizations. So as with them, we were defunded, but we have continued since 2016 and 17 with private funding streams that we have, especially with our national HIV testing week that we have every year now. That is a huge success across Canada that is not funded by any federal or provincial government.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your time with the society, has there been any success that stands out for you?
Well, one of the biggest successes for me would be the national HIV testing. There was something that I saw as a gap for years on the national landscape, contrary to other countries in the G7 or Europe as a whole. So it's something that through our steering committee and our partners throughout the provinces and the territories, we created this space to effect change and to bring more people to know their status that would not know their status normally because they don't automatically gravitate to testing services. So that's one of the biggest successes I have, which I would have, I was part of. The other one would be the research we're doing on cannabis, our transgender modules that we've done, and overall changing the cap of the Canadian AIDS Society to include other things than just HIV, other infections and comorbidities that exist out there.
So, when you mentioned the transgender issue, can you tell me a little about that, how you've provided support there?
Okay, we came out with some transgender documents to support the community 5 years ago. It was a huge milestone that we came to, and that was promoted through our communications people at CAS, and was led by a transgender woman. So it was amazing work that was done, and those documents still exist and are promoted on our website.
Right, thank you.
It was through community consultation of people who were trans, who are trans, I mean, and who developed all the tools through the peer network for that.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for continued work of the society, what would you say?
I think we need to keep an advocacy arm on the federal level, and also an arm that is nimble enough that to address gaps that exist from year to year, because the face of people living with HIV changes dramatically from year to year, depending on the gaps that are developed through care and the treatment cascade that's out there. So we have to be ever vigilant to ensure that through the voice of the people who live with HIV on our board and who are engaged with us, who really direct us in the work that we do to ensure that they are getting the services and the treatment that they need throughout Canada.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Chris Somerville from the Schizophrenia Society. So tell me a little bit about the Schizophrenia Society.
Well, the Schizophrenia Society was started in 1979 by Dr. Bill Jeffries in Toronto, and the Jeffries had a son with schizophrenia. At that time, schizophrenia was so stigmatized, and there was little support for families, that Dr. Jeffries felt that there had to be a better way for families to communicate their particular needs as caregivers and as families. So within a couple of years, there were schizophrenia societies established across the 10 provinces in Canada, mainly as an advocacy voice for families with members who were struggling with schizophrenia.
So these days, are there any myths or stereotypes out there about schizophrenia that you'd like to clear up?
Well, there certainly are. The number one myth about schizophrenia is that people living with schizophrenia are dangerous. So you'll hear statements like, well, just keep them away from my kids, or I don't want them living next door to me. Make sure they take their meds and just basically keep them out of my way. But the reality is that 95% of people living with schizophrenia are not violent, do not come in conflict with the law. For those who do in conflict with law and are violent, generally they're using substances, street drugs, and prior to the schizophrenia had a volatile personality. That was a report by Health Canada that did research on, well, who exactly are the ones that tend to be violent.
So you mentioned the society does some advocacy work. Can you give me an overview of that?
Once we worked to provide a lot of resources for the provincial schizophrenia societies, but in the last 3 years, we did a rebranding and an environmental scan. We found that people wanted us to do more advocacy at the federal level. So I regularly will meet with senators and members of parliament, the finance committee, any group of parliamentarians of any party who want to discuss, like, for example, the current issue is COVID-19. So how does COVID-19 affect people with schizophrenia, and what kind of resources have? So really what we want to do is to be at the table where decisions are made, because if you're not at that table, you're not going to have any influence. And so we want to have influence. And so I do my best then to present the real living situations that people with schizophrenia face, such as lack of affordable housing if there's some disability, lack of decent income security, resources needed, accommodations needed in universities to help those who wish to go back to university and get their education. And then we advocate for peer support, which is a peer support worker is an individual who has lived experience of a mental illness, but also has experienced recovery. And the sooner a recently diagnosed patient sees a peer support worker or meets with one, that inspires some hope that they can get better too when they see how well the peer support worker is living and functioning.
So when you mentioned the COVID situation and its impact on those with schizophrenia, can you tell me a little bit about some of the challenges?
Well, we know that due to the quarantine and isolation that people are experiencing more depression, some more anxiety. There's more despair there because of the isolation. And people who live with schizophrenia tend to live rather isolated lives already. So to compound it by additional isolation increases stress. And we know that stress, one of the main reasons why people have relapses. So it's not just because they're not taking medication, but I believe that most relapse of any mental illness or mental health problem is due to stress, because whatever's going on in the brain, the brain has difficulty dealing with the pressure of stress. So those stressors can lead to relapse, in which there's a return of some of the symptoms of schizophrenia, whether that's hearing voices or having fixed thoughts that have no basis in reality.
So, just out of curiosity, do you know offhand how many people are affected by schizophrenia?
Yeah, around the world, globally, it's about 1% of the population, but you have higher rates of schizophrenia in areas of poverty, inner city. The farther north you go, lack of vitamin D, there seems to be an increase of schizophrenia. We know that many people who experience schizophrenia have had some sort of trauma during their childhood. We would call that an adverse childhood experience. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it was evil. It's not blaming parents or anything like that. It's just that we know that gene expression, how genes express themselves from conception is influenced greatly by the environment. So if there's a negative environment or a traumatic environment, that can be a factor, one of the factors involved in developing schizophrenia or some other mental illness later on.
So, in your time with the society, has there been any success story that you've witnessed?
Well, one of the, I think, good successes we had is when we were doing a lot of advocacy around not criminally responsible because of a mental disorder. So, when Prime Minister Stephen Harper was the Prime Minister, he brought in legislation around the criminal code to make it much more difficult for people with schizophrenia or people who are found not criminally responsible because of a mental disorder. And so their own researchers, and as well as the team that I put together, demonstrated that no matter how, but first of all, less than 1% of people with schizophrenia will ever be under the designation not criminally responsible. So we were effective in terms of a lot of education, dispelling myths and misconceptions that most people who are deemed not criminally responsible because of a mental disorder, it's not because of murder, it's other things, you know, violent assault, that type of thing. The other thing we had to work really hard on, Cam, was recidivism rates, and that is reoffending rates. And we found that people who are released from a federal penitentiary, their recidivism rate, reoffending rates are around 47%, whereas for people with a mental illness like schizophrenia, their reoffending rate was around 7%. So, you know, just sharing a lot of that news, and I did a lot of interviews for 10 years around the Vince Lee story, and that was the Greyhound bus incident in which Mr. Lee thought he was the Chinese Messiah, and that there were aliens, and God had called him to take out the aliens. So when he was on that bus between Portage la Prairie and Winnipeg about 13 years ago, he heard a voice that he thought was God that said, you know, take out that person. Unfortunately, that person was Tim McClain. The other thing we do is we advocate for better medication and social supports for people, as I said earlier. So we advocate for family peer support, family resources, that we can provide a better living conditions for people with schizophrenia. I'm a strong advocate for the recovery-oriented philosophy. So recovery means not a cure, but that people are able to live beyond the limitations of a mental illness with a sense of meaning, purpose, and hope. The difference between that and the medical model is that the medical model tends to fixate on symptom reduction. Recovery is more than symptom reduction. It's regaining a quality of life. So we call that philosophy a recovery life. People are recovering a quality of life. And that's a lot more than medication.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating subject. Many famous people who have struggled with schizophrenia or psychosis. I want to thank you for this interview, and I guess I'd hope that your listeners would know that schizophrenia is treatable and that recovery is possible, but it takes the support of a caring community.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Advertise with CJAM 99.1 FM. We offer the most flexible and competitive rates for radio advertising in Windsor, Detroit. Our diverse programming can fit the needs of a range of organizations and businesses. Choose between daily rates for broad coverage or sponsor a show and target a specific audience. CJAM staff will work with you to craft your ad and choose the airtime that suits your needs. For more information, email statcjam@gmail.com, call 519-253-3000, extension 2525, or go to cjam.ca/advertise.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information on this, check out the ICHA Facebook page. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about AIDS from Gary Lacasse and a little bit about schizophrenia from Chris Somerville.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Julie Brenneiser, who will be giving us an update on the Gorlin Syndrome Alliance. So tell me a little bit about the latest happenings with GSA.
There's a tremendous amount going on at the GSA, in spite of, even with the global pandemic impacting everyone across the globe, we're increasing our social media presence, and we've also started a big project called our Patient Engagement Project, where we're going through our entire database of families to validate their information. So, and this will allow us to have our family, everybody noted and counted, so that when we have information on clinical trials or new treatment possibilities or anything related to Gorlin syndrome, we'll be readily able to share it with them and do so in an accurate manner. Those are two big things that we have going on now. We're also going to be sharing in the near future news of our next meeting, which will be a completely virtual meeting. And I don't want to give too much away quite yet on that. So stay tuned.
So for those who might have missed our previous interview, can you take me through a little bit of how the syndrome affects a person?
Yes. Gorlin syndrome is a rare disease. There are about 1 in 30,000, though the numbers vary on that, are affected. And for most, particularly adults, the most common manifestation that is a huge challenge is dealing with multiple basal cell carcinomas, skin cancers that can develop in sun-exposed and non-sun-exposed parts of the body. We also get tiny little pits on the palms and soles of our feet, and those are usually they don't really generally cause any symptoms. Another manifestation are cysts in the lower and upper jawbone, and those most of the time, but not all the time, diminish as one gets into adulthood, but some adults still do deal with having to have surgical removal of their jaw cysts. The syndrome itself can affect just about every organ system in the body, so one has to be pretty vigilant and monitor their symptoms and have a team of specialists that they work with to check on their various issues that they might have and monitor for those that could develop.
So, in working with families and patients affected with this condition, are there any myths that are typically out there concerning it?
The biggest myth that I see, more from an administrative standpoint and dealing with researchers and pharmaceuticals, is that people will say, oh, it's just a basal cell, have it. You can just have that. One researcher one time told me, you can just have those lopped off. And my response was, yes, but if you get 100 or more in a year, or if you're 10 years old and have 20 on you, that's a big deal. And so calling it just a basal cell is a big myth and almost hurtful to those of us with Gorlin syndrome, because when you get them in the numbers that we do, it's a huge problem and has a huge impact on your life and that of your family.
So, in your time with the GSA, has there been any success that stands out for you?
Our biggest success and what I'm most proud of is our relationships with pharmaceutical companies that are working to develop new treatments, mostly, well, all of them at this time, for our basal cell carcinomas, and developing relationships with them that lead to better treatments and treatments that have fewer side effects is a huge accomplishment. The other thing that I feel really good about is our work in helping the FDA understand our burdens. And so that's something that we'll be doing later this year in an FDA listening session where we'll have 90 minutes in front of various people from the FDA talking to them about what Gorlin syndrome is and how it affects us and our unmet needs. And because part of our challenge in our everyday life with communicating with our physicians is that we as patients or parents have to teach physicians how to take care of us, because it's so rare that they just don't know. And they haven't learned about it in medical school because of the scarcity of people with Gorlin syndrome.
So how do you go about reaching out to patients and families in regards to the work that you do?
In a variety of ways. We're active on Facebook with a public Facebook group and several private pages that are only for affected individuals or parents. We also have a group for teens and young adults that is private. We are active on Instagram, and we have a website that we work to, that's a work in progress, keeping it up to date and active. And so those are the main ways we reach out to people. The other thing that we've become more active doing are virtual Facebook Live webinars with physicians or just talking with families. And finally, we've recently started virtual meetings, community member meetings, where we have a meeting for men, we have a meeting for women under 30 and over 30, we have a meeting for parents, and we have a meeting for those new to the Gorlin Syndrome Alliance or Gorlin Syndrome. And those are monthly meetings that we just started last month, and we're hoping that participation will grow over time.
So, to speak to an earlier point about the myths concerning this condition, what message would you send to the community about what it really is and what it really means?
The biggest message I feel right now is, or the biggest sentiment I have is that there's more and more hope with time for better treatments for our basal cell carcinomas. And that's pretty amazing, because 20, 30 years ago, there really weren't options other than surgical removal. And when you have the volume of basal cells that we do, that can be incredibly depressing. But now there's hope with topicals and oral agents coming out. And the pharmaceutical community sees the need and the desire to work on developing more treatments for children, those under 18, who cannot use some of the topicals and oral treatments. So my main message is one of there is hope for us for the future compared to where we were a number of years ago when the Gorlin Syndrome Alliance, that was called the Basal Cell Carcinoma Nevus Syndrome Life Support Network at that time when it was started.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
During these times of uncertainty and the need to adapt, the more adaptations I hear of, the more innovative concepts of keeping the disabilities work running, the more impressed I am. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.